What? What? What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. In addition to our guest interview, we'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on Too Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. Too Jewish is paid for by Too Jewish Radio Programs and Podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom, Chag Sameach, and Moadim LeSimcha. We have completed the Jewish High Holy Days, so naturally the Hebrew calendar launches us immediately into another major holiday, Sukkot. This is a time of joy for Jews. We are about to celebrate the Feast of Tabernacles, Sukkot. Actually, my favorite Jewish festival, in part because it is not Yom Kippur. No, in fact, I love Sukkot because of the outdoor quality of it, the emphasis on family, friends, guests, and enjoying life, and its central theme of gratitude, which underlies much of what is best about religion in general and Judaism in the specific. Sukkot is the 8-day-long harvest festival commemorating a holiday that is one of the truly ancient ones on our complicated Jewish calendar. In biblical times, Sukkot, also called Sukkot, was referred to as Hechag, the holiday, as though it were the only one, and likely it was the most observed of all festivals ordained in the Torah. Sukkot is the Jewish harvest festival during which we build tabernacles, little huts outside the house that we decorate with fruits and vegetables, and in which we eat and even sleep over the course of the holiday. Sukkot is called Zman Simchatenu, the time of our joy, and it's filled with food, friends, and music, as well as rituals that pay tribute to our reliance upon God for the many good things in our lives. Sukkot is the Jewish Thanksgiving, and in fact, the American holiday of Thanksgiving was based by the Puritan fathers on the biblical Feast of Tabernacles, or Feast of Booths, established in the Torah. In other words, you know, Sukkot. It was particularly important for our ancestors whose whole lives were connected to agricultural production, to farming, herding, and tending orchards and vineyards. A good harvest meant a healthy, safe winter. It was something for which truly to be grateful. The reason Sukkot was most observed of all ancient Jewish festivals is likely because it came at the right time of year. While the Torah specifies 3 separate pilgrimage festivals in which our ancient Israelite ancestors were to travel to Jerusalem to make offerings to God, Passover, Pesach in the spring, Shavuot, the Feast of Weeks, Shavuos in the early summer, and Sukkot in the autumn, there must have been major challenges to farmers inherent on walking to Jerusalem for the first 2 of these 3 festivals. Springtime, when Passover occurs, is a time of planting, weeding, fertilizing, doing all the hard work that will eventually result in a good crop. Early summer, when Shavuot falls, is the time of the first fruits and the early barley crop that must be harvested. And there are many other crops still growing that need to be tended in the diverse Mediterranean agriculture of Israel. But Sukkot comes in the fall, when all the crop yields are complete, and the harvest is in. It's a time of plenty. Must have been an easier season to take a couple of weeks to travel to the capital and celebrate. Sukkot must have been when the greatest crowds arrived in Jerusalem, bringing their agricultural bounty with them, making sacrificial offerings and enjoying feasts each night of the festival. The temporary huts they erected, the Sukkot they built, would have been much like the huts that they used when they stayed in the fields near the crops they were harvesting. It was a time of joy and celebration, of food, drink, and conviviality. And it still is. Sukkot's the time when you are commanded to invite guests to your own sukkah, which reflects on the very structure of a sukkah. It is open. It is usually open on at least one side so that visitors see immediately that they are welcome. In addition to the ritual commandments of sitting in the sukkah and waving the lulav and etrog, the four species with which we celebrate the festival, palm, willow, myrtle, and citron, that symbolize the agricultural nature of the holiday, we also complete the great commandment of hachnasat orchim, welcoming guests. Even luminaries from the Jewish past are invited. They are called ushpizin, like Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph, and so on. Everyone is supposed to enjoy Sukkot. There's a lovely little Yiddish tune about the sukkah, kind of a tradition here on Too Jewish. It's called Asukkala, by the oddly named duo of Suki and Ding.
Asukkala, a kleine, vom Breitalach gemeine, hab ich mir Asukkala gemacht, bedecktem da. Bitabeseles Chag Sitz ich mir in Sikkele Banach Badektem Dach Bitabeseles Chag Sitz ich mir in Sikkele Banach Wind erkalten, lust durch die Spalten, in die lächterlich sei, löschen sich viel. Es ist mir achidisch, wie ich mach mir kidisch, in die lächterlich Sei brennen ganz still. Es ist mir achidisch, wie ich mach mir kidisch. In die Lächterle, sei brennen ganz still. Sei nicht kanal, im Hab nicht. Soll dir die Sicke nicht sein Bang Es ist schon gut Bald 2000 Jahre In die Sicke lese ich steigt noch ganz lang Es ist schon gut
Was a pretty song, Asukkala, for the holiday of Sukkot booths this week. By the way, in Europe, there were even some houses built with a room that had a retractable roof that could be turned into a kind of interior sukkah for the festival, an inside-the-house, outside hut. By Jewish law, a sukkah cannot have more than two permanent walls, so these interior sukkahs made some accommodation by constructing extra walls inside. It speaks to the level of commitment to this holiday and to being Jewishly observant that entire homes were designed with a sukkah, used just 8 days a year, in mind. Our guest this morning on this post-Yom Kippur pre-Sukkot edition of Too Jewish is Elliot Abrams, who helped shape American foreign policy under several presidential administrations. He is focused on Jewish community now, and his new book is called If You Will It, Rebuilding Jewish Community for the 21st Century. Hear all about his recommendations when we return in just a moment on Too Jewish. The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years.
We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470. We are delighted to welcome the Two Jewish, our guest this morning. Elliot Abrams has helped shape American foreign policy in a variety of administrations at the highest level. He most famously served as, a whole bunch of jobs, Deputy National Security Advisor, Assistant Secretary of State for Inter-American Affairs, United States Special Representative for Venezuela, U.S. Special Representative for Iran. His new book is called, If You Will It, Rebuilding Jewish Peoplehood for the 21st Century. Good morning and welcome to Two Jewish.
Good morning. Very glad to be talking with you.
And Shana Tova. Good New Year.
Shana Tova.
So why write this book now?
I wrote it now because there's a lot of data that came in the last few years about the American Jewish community, and because we face some significant challenges now. And in many cases, I think we're not handling those challenges very well. I think the American Jewish community has, in many ways, too positive a sense of how we're doing in the United States. And the numbers don't really bear that out.
I want to talk about the fact that you focus on solutions, because I think Jews are very good at trying and talking about what's wrong. But tell us a little bit, not about your solutions, we'll save that for later, but why did you approach it that way instead of just saying, oh my goodness, this is terrible?
Well, that doesn't help. It doesn't help to just analyze the problem and say, man, are we in trouble? People want to know. I mean, donors want to know, parents want to know, grandparents want to know what can be done. I should also say I wrote a book about the American Jewish community, Faith or Fear, about 25 years ago. And I said there that ethnicity is declining and studying the Holocaust isn't going to save us. The only thing that is certain in work is the religion of Judaism. I'm revisiting it now because I think that's a very nice thing to say, but it's impractical. 10% of American Jews are Orthodox. 90% are not. And you can't say to people, hey, you ought to be more religious. That's not a sensible solution. So what I was looking for was sensible, workable things to say to philanthropists, to say to NGOs and Jewish organizations, to say to families that are concerned about whether their children and grandchildren are going to remain Jewish, feel themselves part of the Jewish people, have a strong Jewish identity. What do we do?
We will talk about exactly what you think we should do. We come back in a moment with Elliot Abrams here on Two Jewish. Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a fabulous Jewish synagogue in northwest Tucson and the Catalina foothills, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this fall, established 6 years ago by the great congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Beit Simcha is a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. Progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the Catalina foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everybody throughout the Tucson metro area.
providing weekly Shabbat services Friday night at 6:30 p.m., Saturday morning at 10 a.m., preceded by Torah study at 9 a.m., Youth and Adult Education Academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Join us in person for Shabbat services or come on Facebook Live. Go to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org. We welcome members and guests at all services and classes. Call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675. Religious school is going strong for school-aged children and grandchildren. Join us in our fabulous Hebrew school, bar and bat mitzvah programs, Torah Tikes experience for the youngest kids, confirmation and teen programs, all in a fun, relaxed setting with fabulous Jewish learning. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org to sign up. Beit Simcha's services, classes, and events are open to everyone Friday night or Saturday morning or both. 6:30 p.m. Friday night services in person, followed always by an Oneg Shabbat. Saturday morning services are preceded at 9 a.m. by Torah study, always with bagels and lox. 10 a.m. services, all with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. Or you can go to our Facebook page, Beit Simcha Tucson, BeitSimcha Tucson. All of our Adult Education Academy classes are live and on Zoom. For more information about Beit Simcha, to come to services, religious school, Torah Tikes program, bar and bat mitzvah, confirmation, high school program, rich array of Adult Education Academy courses taught live and on Zoom, and all of our services in person and on Facebook, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, at Beit Simcha, the fastest growing Jewish congregation in all of Southern Arizona. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's T-O-O Jewish Radio 18 at gmail.com. Or visit our website, 2JewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website. Streaming us from there, downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store is very popular Jewish podcasts. Top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine. Over 200,000 downloads on Podbean and on Spotify, too. Post a rating, review 2Jewish wherever you listen to us. Those comments are a big help. There was a fun, semi-viral concluding song used by a synagogue last week, the end of Rosh Hashanah services. It comes from New York, and it featured Broadway performers at Park Avenue Synagogue, actually on the Bima, singing Jonathan Larson's marvelous Seasons of Love from the musical Rent. Jonathan Larson was Jewish, of course. Rent premiered just before he tragically died from a misdiagnosed heart problem at the age of just 35. Who shall live and who shall die indeed, as the Unetane Tokev prayer said on both Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. It was, this piece, I think, an inspired choice for concluding hymn on Rosh Hashanah, especially for a conservative synagogue. They are not exactly known for their creativity. Anyway, here's the version they performed of Seasons of Love.
Our response authentically is by way of love. Seasons of Love.
Miles and laughter is driving 525,000. 525,000 journeys to plan.
525,600 minutes.
How can you measure the life of a woman or a man?
In truths that she learned or in times that he cried.
In bridges she burned or the way that he died.
Remember a year in the life of friends.
Love, love,
you had to, remember.
Love,
like you give this from above.
That was Seasons of Love. May this 5785 year provide a number of much better seasons than the last Jewish calendar year did. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Well, we talked nationally, not quite as internationally last week, about the development in particular of the Jewish community you grew up in St. Louis. All American communities, Jewish communities, are the result of various waves of Jewish immigration from lots of different places in the globe. You know, the first significant Jewish communities were Sephardic in New York, where they came up from Recife, Brazil, and Charleston, South Carolina, and, you know, all of these different kind of coastal enclaves, Philadelphia, they had Sephardic congregations. And that was followed by a big wave of German immigration, seeking more liberal, more accepting, less anti-Semitic climate in the 1840s and 50s. I have some relatives that came over then, some of whom married into Sephardic families, actually. And then the huge wave that most American Jews feel like were descended from, the so-called Russian Jews, but that's really from 1880s to like the 1920s, and it includes Jews from Eastern Europe, Central Europe, Western Europe, and the various parts of what later became or was then part of the Russian Empire, but also Jews from everywhere in the world. And then later migrations too, which affected things, Jews from the former Soviet Union, Jews coming from Arab countries. You know, there have been very interesting and different, I think, sequences that have affected development of Jewish communities in America.
Right. It's interesting to me that, like most Americans, you omitted in your little overview the Balkans.
Yeah,
think
I kind of did.
American
I don't know
Jews
what to do with the
either
Balkans.
Right? Romania or Hungary
or
what used to be Turkey in Europe, it was called until 1913, or in some places till 1878. A lot of American Jews have their roots in that corner of Europe, and they're pretty diverse. You know, they live in Seattle, they live in Rochester, New York, they live all over the place, but they're from
the Balkans,
that corner that we always forget.
Yeah.
And
it's
Hungarians will dispute
that.
Being referred to as Balkans, because technically,
it's
geographically,
really,
they're not.
Not exactly.
But they're not Slavs. They were never part of the Tsarist Empire. They were part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, so a lot of Hungarians were bilingual, but still very distinct from German Jews.
Yeah, it's definitely a unique and a significant Jewish community. I remember when I was a rabbinic intern in Sydney, Australia, huge Hungarian Jewish population there, because a lot of them not only came over before World War II, but a lot of them came over after the communist takeover of Hungary and all of that stuff in the 1950s. It was somewhat eye-opening for me, because it's a different culture still.
Yeah, and it was a much earlier communist takeover of Hungary, which is, I think, what caused my grandparents to emigrate right after World War I.
Right after, sure. It was
like long before
the 1956 collapse, right, of the, what was it called?
No. Nothing to do with that.
Okay, sorry.
This is, there was a brief communist regime in Hungary in the early 1920s. and a lot of people fled from that.
That was after the collapse of the Austro-Hungarian
Empire.
Correct.
There was no more empire. There was no more Kaiser in Vienna. And it was like a confusing time. And the Hungarians experimented with several different forms of government, most of which failed. And eventually, the Soviet Union took over in the wake of World War II. But that was like 25 years later.
So there were very good reasons for Hungarian Jews to leave.
Yeah.
And they did. In coming back to the way that these American Jewish communities developed, you know, each of these groups often started their own synagogues, right?
Right.
Although sometimes the German Jews took over the Sephardic synagogues and made them into German Reform synagogues. Charleston, South Carolina is a good example of that. It's a very interesting process. That's not what the more recent Jewish communities have come to manifest. And it'd be interesting to explore, like, you know, you used to kind of know where you were and where the background of the people forming the synagogue came from. I don't think that's true anymore.
Right. And also, an interesting question to explore at some point might be, to what extent do immigrants influence a Jewish community? And to what extent does the existing wider community, I'm thinking particularly of St. Louis, influence the formation and the evolution of the local Jewish community? I mean, for example, St. Louis has always been very welcoming of very diverse populations. And for a while, it was a bilingual city in the 1860s, 70s, 80s. There were daily newspapers in German. There were schools that were bilingual in German and English. And now, St. Louis is the capital of Bosnian America. St. Louis has like 300,000 or 400,000 Bosniaks, more than any city in the world except for Sarajevo. And that welcoming nature might affect the evolution of the Jewish community as much as groups of Jewish immigrants affect that same evolution.
We will talk about that next time. Tom, thanks so much. We'll talk then.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie new, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. This one, a slightly leftover High Holy Days classic. Palestinian terrorist burst into a shul just before Yom Kippur, demanding $20 million as a ransom and a jet plane to escape. The governor says no. The terrorists then announce they will kill in quick succession three people, and they choose the rabbi, the cantor, and the synagogue president. They tell the rabbi, "We're going to kill you first." Any last requests? "Just one," says the rabbi. "All my life, I've wanted to give the perfect sermon. This time, for Kol Nidre, for Yom Kippur, I've worked on my sermon for months. It's an hour long. Before you kill me, I'd like to give my sermon." "No problem," says the chief terrorist. "Give your sermon, then we'll kill you." He turns to the cantor. "You're next to die. Any last requests?" "Only one," says the chazan. "All my life, I've wanted to sing the perfect Kol Nidre service. This year I've practiced and practiced. It's polished to perfection. Before you kill me, I'd like to sing it." "How long will it take?" asks the terrorist. 2 hours, says the cantor. "No problem," says the terrorist. "Sing it and we'll kill you." He then turns to the president. "What is your last request?" "Only one," says the president of the congregation. "Kill me first." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week we read a special section from the Torah in honor of the upcoming holiday of Sukkot, which begins Wednesday night and lasts for 8 days. This season provides an embarrassment of holiday riches for Jews, and the Torah reading, I should more properly say readings, reflect this. Sukkot, the great fall Thanksgiving festival, the Feast of Tabernacles or Booths, commands us to remember the transitory nature of our ancestors' wanderings through the wilderness of Sinai, as well as the transitory nature of our own lives. In the season of the fall harvest, when we eat the first and best of the produce of the natural world, we take a week to demonstrate gratitude for the necessities of life: food, shelter, clothing.
And in this week's Torah reading, we receive the mitzvah to build a sukkah, a temporary tabernacle, that booth or hut outdoors, designed to last just a week, well, 8 days really, to eat in and perhaps sleep in. We decorate it with symbols of the harvest, fruits and vegetables, and enjoy a fall festival celebrating the goodness of the world that God has given us. It's a great lesson in appreciating the gifts we've received and the many good things that we have. Gratitude is an experience few of us can maintain for long, but it is the essential source of so much that is profoundly religious and profoundly good. So may it be for each of us in this week dedicated to gratitude. But there's also one special additional reading we include on this festival, not from the Torah itself, but from the latter stages of the Bible, the Ketuvim, or the writings. Ecclesiastes, Kohelet, the beautiful biblical book chanted on the Shabbat of Sukkot, is perhaps the single most beautiful piece of literature in all history. Succinct, poetic, gorgeous, wise. It includes famous phrases that have become part of our language. The sun also rises. There is nothing new under the sun. All rivers run to the sea, but the sea is not full. For everything there's a time, a season, for every purpose under heaven. The earth returns to the dust that it was, but the spirit returns to God who gave it. The conclusion of Kohelet of Ecclesiastes is simple but powerful. After a poetic search of wisdom and folly, a survey of what the world has to offer, the author concludes, "The end of the matter, all having been heard, is to revere God. Keep the mitzvot, the commandments, for that makes the complete human being." As autumn approaches, Kohelet reminds us that so much of what we do is vanity, vapor. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity, the book begins, and compels us to realize God is our true source of meaning and beauty. All this, and a joyous time of year, it's a sobering but truly magnificent reminder of what really matters. Even, perhaps especially, at seasons of joy and times of gladness, we need to remember that our greatest success comes from our integrity. When we come back in a moment, Elliot Abrams, a shaper of U.S. foreign policy under several presidential administrations, has turned his attention to fixing the American Jewish world. His new book is called If You Will It, Reshaping Jewish Peoplehood for the 21st Century. Hear all about it when we return in a moment right here on Too Jewish.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
War continues to rage in Lebanon and Gaza, and Israel is contemplating its direct response to Iran, firing missiles at it, lots of them. While missiles and rockets have been fired into Israel from Lebanon, as well, of course, as from Iran, very little damage appears to have occurred there, thanks to the Iron Dome and other defensive systems. In Lebanon, the Hezbollah terrorists appear to be in a fairly desperate condition at the moment. Last week, they actually called for an unconditional ceasefire. The Israeli incursion has uncovered a terrorist tunnel network that was to be used for an invasion of Israel, similar, but perhaps even more devastating, than the October 7th atrocities of last year. It remains unclear what Israel's war goals are in Lebanon against Hezbollah. If it is just to return Israeli citizens to their homes in the north after over a year as internal refugees, well, the IDF seems close to achieving that. If it is instead to destroy Hezbollah, we can expect a much longer war. But Israel's intelligence and battlefield success thus far are nothing short of shocking. No one expected Hezbollah to be rolled up as they have been. In Israel itself, Rabbi Raphael Mordechai Fischoff, who is aged 35, he was critically wounded during the stabbing attack in Hadera last week, perpetrated by a terrorist, died. Fischoff was a resident of Hadera and the father of seven. Six people were wounded in the stabbing attack in Hadera before the terrorist was neutralized.
The attack occurred in four different locations, the terrorist fleeing on a scooter before finally being stopped by an armed civilian. During the manhunt, police officers deployed a helicopter and searched the streets. The terrorist was identified as Ahmad Jabarin, a 36-year-old Israeli Arab citizen from Umm Al Fahm. Police found an axe and a knife blade covered in blood on him. Today, I'd like to pay tribute to a teacher of mine, Cantor Naftali Hershtick of blessed memory, whose soulful, resonant tenor, amazing falsetto, and elegant interpretations of Jewish liturgical music made him one of the most renowned and influential cantors of our time, died last month at his home in Ra'anana, Israel. He was 77 years old. His son, Netanel, is the prominent cantor of the Hampton Synagogue in New York. Hershtick was a throwback to the golden age of Chazanim, when cantors like Yosla Rosenblatt and Moshe Kusevitzky filled thousand-seat shuls on a Shabbos or a Jewish holiday, drawing connoisseurs eager to hear lyrical praise delivered by glorious and powerful voices. Known for his silken-voiced tenor, Naftali Hershtick had an extraordinary range, three octaves, comfortable in bass, the high C register, or that falsetto. Equally important was his gift, conveying the emotions of these great prayers. The son of Holocaust survivors, Hershtick had an unparalleled ability to hold a congregation in the palm of his hand with his chazonos. I had the privilege of studying with him when I was a rabbinical student in Jerusalem back in 1991 to 1992. Hershtick was a true gentleman, and while I certainly never ascended to his heights as a cantor, he taught me a great deal about interpretation and vocal elegance. Hershtick was the first cantor of the Great Synagogue in Jerusalem when it was built in 1982. He led services there for 30 years, from 82 to 2012. During his time there, every sitting Israeli prime minister, from Menachem Begin to Yitzhak Rabin, Shimon Peres, Ehud Barak, and Bibi Netanyahu, visited and listened to him sing at worship services. To hear him lead Shabbat services with its superb male choir at the Great Synagogue was to experience the finest level Jewish liturgical music has perhaps ever reached. Naftali Hershtick, whose family immigrated to Israel after World War II, was a founder of the Tel Aviv Cantorial Institute, a training ground for Orthodox cantors like Yitzchak Meir Helfgott of the Park East Synagogue, as well as for those affiliated with the conservative and reform movements, like me. Although virtually all Orthodox synagogues allow only men to lead worship, Hershtick trained women to become cantors in other movements. Hershtick also performed liturgical music and operatic arias on stage. He appeared with the London Festival Orchestra, the Israel Philharmonic, the London Mozart Players, and he recorded with the London Jewish Male Choir, the Brno Philharmonic, and the Czech Republic, and others. After retiring from the Great Synagogue, he led High Holy Day services annually at the Moscow Chorale Synagogue. May Hershtick now rest in peace. A last song for him,
Hoshana, a prayer for Sukkot, coming up this week.
Hoshana, 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 Hoshana.
And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Round the World. We are delighted to welcome back the Two Jewish, our guests this morning. Elliot Abrams has served at the highest levels of the American government in a variety of influential positions, perhaps best known for his work in Latin America. He is also a committed Jew, and his new book is called, If You Will It, Rebuilding Jewish Peoplehood for the 21st Century. So for a long time, we have seen this kind of erosion of liberal Judaism. I don't mean politically liberal. I mean people that are not Orthodox. As you said, 90% of American Jews are not Orthodox, and the vast majority of them aren't going to become so. What is it, in looking at the successes within American Judaism, where do you think we should put more emphasis?
Three things. The first is better education. And that means partly making it possible for families that would like to use Jewish day school to do so, and that's a financial question for many. But it also means improving on the kind of Hebrew school education that so many Americans get, at least before their bar mitzvah or bat mitzvah. The quality is extremely uneven. In some synagogues, it's terrific. In many synagogues, it is not terrific. Kids drift away after the bar bat mitzvah. So we need to improve the quality of Jewish education in America, and that's not impossible. The second thing is Jewish summer camp. And I think people don't take it seriously enough. I mean, the immigrant generation who came here lived in dense Jewish neighborhoods. They had a kind of immersive Jewish experience. And their children did too in that first generation born here. We don't. So we need to create it intentionally. And if it isn't the Jewish day school, and for most of us it isn't, summer camping does create a fully Jewish 24/7 experience for young Jews with Jewish role models, for counselors, in many camps with young Israelis as counselors. So summer camping is really important in creating Jewish identity. We can come back to that, but just let me mention the third thing, Israel. Time in Israel. There's 20 years of data showing that birthright has a real impact on many of the young Jews who took part.
Absolutely.
10 days. So think about a month, or how about a summer in Israel, or a semester in Israel, or junior year abroad, or gap year. Those will have many, many more times the effect, and will have a life-changing experience for many young Jews.
So I want to go back to each of those points, education, and you write about them extensively, education, summer camping, connection to Israel, and you're focused on young people's connections. I can tell you that if summer camp to
did not cost nearly as much as sending your kid to college, it would certainly attract more. Well, I don't know. Sending your kid to college now has gone, you know, it's pretty much like sending your child to the, to Mars. They're comparable in expense. We have a lot of Jewish philanthropists. There are an unbelievable number of Jewish organizations that are funded. If Jewish summer camp costs nothing or some small fraction of what it actually costs, if there was such a fund, lots more parents would send their kids to Jewish camps.
I agree with that. And I think there are some experiments where a little bit of the cost is defrayed. You get a couple $1,000s.
Sure.
Or you get more for the first year in the hope that then you and your children will be hooked. But I remember talking to Rabbi Fink in Boise, Idaho, tiny Jewish community. And I asked him, you know, there's no Jewish community center. There are not many activities. What do you do to create a sense of Jewish camp, summer camp, in their case, across in Washington State? But it's critical. I think part of the problem with Jewish philanthropy today is everybody wants to do his own thing. The idea of, you know, giving money to the Federation, send kids to camp, strikes some philanthropists as too old-fashioned, too boring. But that's what we need. As you were saying, if you can lower the cost, kids have to do something in the summer. If you can lower the cost to something reasonable, bearable, more people will go. If you divide the American Jewish community into quartiles in income, in the lower quartile, just about nobody goes to camp because it's too
darned expensive. It just is. And I agree, it should be a higher priority, but we have to deal with people where they are, don't we?
We do. And I think there are no ideological barriers to going to Jewish summer camps. And again, the kids have to do something during the summer. For most families, I mean, for the upper quartile in income, they may have a summer home, or the whole family may go, you know, take a tour someplace. But for most Jewish families, you need to find a healthy activity for the kids. And if the money were there, more kids would be going to Jewish summer camps. It's really a shame that more philanthropy is not available.
So I think it's more than a shame. I think it's a misdirection of resources because there's no shortage of resources in truth in the Jewish world. I guess I would apply that to the first one. I want to just talk about money today, but Jewish education, why is the quality so varied? Well, if teachers were paid to run, you know, if Jewish educators were treated as a highly specialized and super important profession, I think we'd have a different situation in Jewish education.
I think that's right. I would add to that, you do have to blame the parents somewhat. I mean, there's a lot of Jewish parents who, you know, if the kid comes home from school with mediocre grades, would be very upset because they want the kid to get into a good college. But not for Hebrew school, where it's much less significant to many, many parents. I wonder if we should challenge also the model that every synagogue should have its own Hebrew school. It may be unreasonable to think that, you know, every synagogue in America is going to be able to put together a really first-grade Hebrew school. And there are some experiments, I mean, Houston is one, for example, where the synagogues get together for post-bar mitzvah Jewish education, and it kind of rotates from synagogue to synagogue for a program that creates more of a community of Jewish young people. And because there's only one teaching corps instead of 10 or 15 or 20, is able to get better teachers.
I want to thank Elliot Abrams for a great visit here on Two Jewish. Where can people go to find out more about, if you will it, your new book, Rebuilding Jewish People for the 21st Century, and to find out more about you?
The best way on the book is just look it up on Amazon. Amazon, if you will it, Abrams, and we'll tell you more about the book and how to get the book. And for me, I'd say go to the Council on Foreign Relations website, CFR.org, and look me up.
And I didn't ask you a single question about foreign affairs. I'll tell you, it's I feel like I have to get you back on to talk about that.
Happy to do it. Fortunately, plenty to talk about.
Thank you so much. Shana Tova and Chag Sameach.
Shana Tova. Thank you.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of Southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next week. Our guest will be Liz Hirsch Naftali, author of the gripping memoir Saving Abigail, true story of the abduction and rescue of a 3-year-old hostage. It's about her own great-niece's parents' murder at the hands of Palestinian terrorists and the successful effort to bring the 3-year-old hostage back home, along with her siblings, to her surviving relatives in Israel. Please join us at Congregation Beit Simcha Friday night for services in Onig Shabbat at 6:30 p.m. By the way, we also have Sukkot morning services this Thursday at 9:30 a.m. Saturday morning, too, 9 a.m. Torah study, 10 a.m. services, Torah reading and Kiddush in person and on our Facebook page. And go to BeitSimchaTucson.org. We have all kinds of stuff coming up for the holiday of Sukkot. Our playout this morning comes from the late Rabbi Shlomo Karlbach for Sukkot. Ufros aleinu sukkat shlomecha, spread over us the sukkah of your peace, please God, and of your compassion and life. My friends, may you have a Chag Sameach, a happy holiday of Sukkot, starting Wednesday night for 8 days. And Moadim l'simcha, Chagim uzmanim l'sason, seasons of joy and holidays of celebration and love. And, of course, a Shavua Tov, a good week, a healthy week, and a week and a year, we pray profoundly, of justice and peace.
Sponsored by Two Jewish Radio Programs, Tucson, Arizona.